mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't an orchard anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.
There's a new tech boom happening in Portland. This spring, Airbnb decided to relocate its North American headquarters in Portland. eBay also recently doubled its office space downtown. This means new jobs. This means more people moving to Portland. It also means rising rents. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for Startup City, the first in a five-part series on how the new tech boom is changing Portland.
Now, that's not to be confused with the song Waltzing Matilda. Yes. Hold on a second.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:01 a.m. Coming up, Air Cascadia's off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, which features a speech given in Berkeley by Naomi Klein for her latest book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. At 11, hear Startup City, a five-week series looking at the new tech industry in the Portland area. And at 11:10 on the Radio Zine, host Per Fagering speaks with Philip Camella, practicing attorney, radio show host, and author of The Collapse of Materialism, about human consciousness, the mind, and matter. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support, which helped us end our recent membership drive early. That's right. And if you missed it, you can still make your financial investment in community radio at kboo.fm. You click on the cartoon jar in the top right-hand corner where it says Donate Today. And now Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, we proudly present an encore broadcast of a speech given in Berkeley by Naomi Klein for her latest book, This Changes Everything: Capitalism Versus the Climate. My name is Mike Biggs, and for Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. This is a brand new book by Naomi Klein. This book, forget everything you think you know about global warming. The really inconvenient truth is that it's not about carbon, it's about capitalism. The convenient truth is that we can seize this existential crisis to transform our failed economy and economic system and build something radically better. I'm for that. In her most provocative book yet, Naomi Klein tackles the most profound threat humanity has ever faced. The war our economic model is waging against life on Earth. Here's Naomi Klein.
It's so good to be here. I'm so happy to be here, and I want to thank everybody who has made this evening possible, everybody at KPFA and Earth Island Journal, and especially my friends at Movement Generation, who in so many ways have been my teachers, an incredible group, not just of activists, but really of intellectuals, of organic intellectuals, who are theorizing this climate justice movement into being, along with so many other people around the world. And I'm just so grateful for their work. And I don't do this, but I'm going to start my talk actually by just reading a little passage from the book. I don't usually do this kind of reading, but I'm going to do it in this case because I think it for me, it sets the stage a little bit of some of the personal stakes when we engage with an issue this big. This is a short passage from the introduction to This Changes Everything. What gets me most are not the scary scientific studies about melting glaciers, the ones I used to avoid. It's the books I read to my two-year-old. Looking for a Moose is one of his favorites. It's about a bunch of kids that really, really, really want to see a moose. Have you ever seen a moose? They ask. They search high and low, through a forest, a swamp, in brambly bushes, up a mountain, for a long-legged, bulgy-nosed, branchy-antler moose. The joke is that there are moose hiding on every page. In the end, the animals all come out of hiding, and the ecstatic kids proclaim, "We've never, ever, ever, ever seen so many moose." Now, my son loves this book, and on about the 75th reading, it suddenly hit me. He might never see a moose. I tried to hold it together. I went back to my computer and began to write about my time in northern Alberta, tar sands country, where members of the Beaver Lake Cree First Nation told me about how the moose had changed. One woman described finding a moose on a hunting trip, only to discover that the flesh had already turned green. I heard a lot about strange tumors, too, which locals assumed had to do with the animals drinking water contaminated by tar sands toxins. But mostly, I heard about how the moose were simply gone, and not just in Alberta. "Rapid climate change turns North Woods into moose graveyard," reads a May 2012 headline in Scientific American. A year and a half later, the New York Times was reporting that one of Minnesota's two moose populations had declined from 4,000 in the 1990s to just 100 today. Will he ever see a moose? Then the other day, I was slain by a miniature board book called Snuggle Wuggle. It involves different animals cuddling, with each posture given a ridiculously silly name. "How does a bat hug?" it asks. "Topsy-turvy, topsy-turvy." For some reason, my son reliably cracks up at this page. I explain that topsy-turvy means upside down because that's the way bats sleep. But all I can think about are the reports of some 100,000 dead and dying bats raining down from the sky in the midst of record-breaking heat across part of Queensland, Australia, whole colonies devastated. Will he ever see a bat? I knew I was in trouble the other day when I found myself bargaining with starfish. Red and purple ones are ubiquitous on the rocky coast of British Columbia, where my parents live, where my son was born, where I have spent about half my adult life. They're always the biggest kid pleasers because you can gently pick one up and give it a really good look. "This is the best day of my life," my 7-year-old niece Miriam, visiting from Chicago, proclaimed after a long afternoon spent in the tide pools. But in the fall of 2013, stories began to appear about a strange wasting disease that was causing starfish along the Pacific coast to die in the tens of thousands, termed the sea star wasting syndrome. Multiple species were disintegrating alive, their vibrant bodies melting into distorted globs, with legs falling off and bodies caving in. Scientists were mystified. As I read these stories, I caught myself praying for the invertebrates to hang in for just one more year, long enough for my son to be amazed by then. Then I doubted myself. Maybe it's better if he never sees a starfish at all. Certainly not like this. When fear like that used to creep through my armor of climate change denial, I would do my utmost to stuff it away, change the channel, click past it. Now I try to feel it. It seems to me that I owe it to my son, just as we all owe it to ourselves and to one another. But what should we do with this fear that comes from living on a planet that is dying, made less alive every day? First, accept that it won't go away, that it is a fully rational response to an unbearable reality. Next, use it. Fear is a survival response. Fear makes us run, it makes us leap, it makes us act superhuman. But we need somewhere to run to. Without that, fear is just paralyzing. So the real trick, the only hope, really, is to allow the terror of an unlivable future to be balanced and soothed by the prospect of building something much better than many of us had previously dared hope. Yes, there will be things we will lose, luxuries some of us will have to give up, whole industries that will disappear. And it's too late to stop climate change from coming. It is already here, and increasingly brutal disasters are headed our way no matter what we do. But it's not too late to avert the worst. And there is still time to change ourselves so that we are far less brutal to one another when those disasters strike. And that, it seems to me, is worth a great deal. Because the thing about a crisis this big, this all-encompassing, is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and our leaders. It means there is a whole lot of stuff we have been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means there is a whole lot of stuff we have been told is impossible that has to start happening right away. Can we pull it off? All I know is that nothing is inevitable. Nothing except that climate change changes everything. And for a very brief time, the nature of that change is still up to us. So that is the end of the reading portion of the evening. Thank you. So I called the book This Changes Everything because I think it's important to start the discussion from the premise that we have passed the point where non-radical options are on the table. We only have radical options in front of us. If we stay on the road we're on, the road that is sometimes called business as usual, scientists tell us, and also some of the most conservative institutions in the world, like the World Bank, the International Energy Agency, PricewaterhouseCoopers, tell us that we are on a road leading us to 4 to 6 degrees of warming Celsius. 6 degrees is 10.7 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? That changes everything about our physical world. That much we know. We don't know exactly what it looks like because all the climate models break down at that point, but we know we're talking about whole cities disappearing, whole countries, crop failure. I don't want to get all apocalyptic on you. We're talking about everything changing, about our physical world, and all we have to do to get to that place is nothing. Just keep on keeping on. They call that business as usual. Now, there are people out there who will tell you that we can avert some of the worst of that, but in order to do that, we have to engage in radical engineering interventions in our climate system. Spray sulfur into the stratosphere to try to dim the sun, or fertilize our oceans to try to trap carbon. Needless to say, there are some risks associated with these ideas. These are radical options. We can avert these outcomes. It is not too late to give ourselves a really good shot at preventing catastrophic climate change. But these also involve radical changes. Changes, radical changes to our political and economic system. Reformism, tweaking around the edges, that time has passed. There is, as Michael Mann says, the Penn State climate scientist who wrote The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, a procrastination penalty to doing nothing about climate change. That's the nature of greenhouse gases. They build up in the atmosphere. If you let them build up at the same time as scientists are warning you for 2.5 decades that there will be disastrous outcomes, then you then have to cut them so quickly that the impacts are radical. And that's where we are right now. That we need to cut globally our emissions by 6% a year if we want to hold on to a 50-50 chance of staying below 2 degrees warming Celsius. Now, the trick is that's not 6% everywhere in the world because our governments have agreed to a principle of that we need to respond to this with some sense of equity, historical responsibility, which means that the countries that got a 200-year head start on emitting carbon have to start cutting first. So that means, according to leading climate scientists at the Tyndall Center in England, that in countries like the United States, in the country where I live, Canada, we need to start cutting our emissions by 8 to 10% a year. That is not compatible with an economic system built on perpetual growth. And that's where we get into these deep challenges. And we can talk more about that later. But this is the premise that I start with. And that's why I chose the title of the book, because I think we need to start our discussions from this point, as opposed to pretending that it's still 1992 and we're still talking about these sort of gentle tweaks that can get us out of this. There is a procrastination penalty. Emissions are up 61% since our governments started negotiating to lower our emissions. So, I see this book as a sequel to the shock doctrine in a very real way. And I'll tell you why I see it that way. The shock doctrine, as Jason said, and as many of you know, is a book about how our elites have advanced a very radical, fundamentalist version of capitalism in the midst of crises. In the aftermath of major shocks, wars, coups, natural disasters. And the book begins and ends with Hurricane Katrina, which for me always was the most devastating illustration of this tactic, the baldest illustration of this tactic. And I think it's worth talking about a little bit because it has to do with climate change. And it also has to do with what is making climate change worse. In the shock doctrine, I describe Katrina and its impact.